oral history recording at Westminster School on the 26th of June 2014 with Elizabeth Wells, archivist,
Harriet Costello, archives assistant,
and John Keynes, pupil, ex.
So, to get started, I wondered if you'd just tell us a little bit about your family background, a bit about your parents.
Well, my father and my parents had no connection with Westminster at all. My father was employee of Lloyds Bank and eventually became a branch bank manager in the country. My mother was a teacher and had herself been to university at what was then Exeter College of the West, part of London University, and read modern languages there and subsequently taught languages. I was born in Sherborne in Dorset, where my father was working in the bank, and was sent to Sherborne Preparatory School. And Sherborne had sent, I think, had had three successful entries to the challenge over the years, and the the second master thought that I should be a candidate in due course or at some point for that, and not go on to Sherborne School, because I wasn't very keen or good at games, and Sherborne's rather gamesy school, and Westminster at least gave you credit for things other than games. And he presumably thought that I was suitable for the challenge, and so I sat the challenge for Westminster in 1945, never having set foot in London in my life. And so when, to my surprise, I got the third scholarship in 1945 and came up in September, here was I in London for the first time in my life.
So you must have been in Dorset during pretty much all of the Second World War.
Yes, indeed. It was bombed in Dorset.
Really?
Sherborne was one afternoon bombed, simply because the aeroplanes couldn't unload their bombs where they really wanted to, and saw a nice abbey and dropped them on Sherborne. But I was there, yes, all through the war.
What were your parents doing in the war? Did they do any war work?
No, my father was in the First World War. He wasn't in the Second World War. He continued to work in the bank. And in 1940, we left Sherborne and went to Wiltshire, which is when he attained his great aim of being a bank manager, as they were in those days.
Goodness. And were you sort of conscious? You must have been very young when war broke out.
Yes, so I was very young. I was six. Yes, I was six. I was in the Isle of Wight on holiday and had to cross the submarine-infested waters of the Solent on my I thought we would be torpedoed between Ryde and Portsmouth. But yes, and so, yes, I was very young.
And were you very conscious as you grew older about what was going on?
Oh, yes, one was. You know, the headmaster used to keep us fully informed, and we were suitably indoctrinated about how evil and wicked the Germans were, and how you had to hang out your washing on the Siegfried Line, and all those patriotic songs. And then on June the 6th, I don't think I'm making this up, I'm quite sure that I heard the distant rumble of guns in 1944. I don't think that's improbable from Sherborne. It couldn't have been thunderstorms. I had no idea that D-Day was taking place. But then, at breakfast, we heard the Normandy landings had taken place.
Was it the headmaster again, or
what? Who said?
Who announced it?
I think yes. He probably told us. Yeah, oh yes, he was very keen about all that sort of thing.
And do you remember VE Day?
I was in London for VE. No, I wasn't in London for VE Day. 1945. No, it was the Victory Parade. There was a huge Victory Parade in 1946, which was 1 year after VE, which we watched from the school and then from barges on the river watch the fireworks. But no, 1945, yes, I was, yes, I must have been, yes, I was in Sherborne on VJ Day. I was on holiday in Sussex, so yes, I remember those events. Don't really remember VE Day. I can remember VJ Day more, and I remember the victory parade. We stood out there and watched everything go by.
In front of Parliament?
Yeah, yes, yeah. You know, by where the statue of King George, where we watched. I don't know if they still do it. The state opening of Parliament.
Oh yes, people still go out sometimes
and
to watch that.
We were allowed to cheer during the national anthem. We weren't obliged to stand to attention. The pupils of Westminster, we were told by ancient tradition, were allowed and expected to cheer during the national anthem. I don't know if that still happens.
No, I don't think they're aware of.
No,
that
well, we used to most times go out and watch the state opening from there. And we also were allowed to attend debates in Parliament. I don't know if that, the scholars, provided
the
we wore our gowns, yes. And as in 1945, there hadn't been any for Westminster's there for 4 or 5 years, they were awfully interested when they started, when some of the, I remember in the House of Lords, some of the peers, you know, saw us arriving and would show us round and show us King Charles's death warrant and various things of that kind. We were welcomed back.
That's wonderful.
But then I've digressed.
No, that's good. It's all about digression. So you came to Westminster as at the challenge, you said.
One sat at school. One didn't sit in London. I sat at a school.
You did? Okay.
No, I didn't come to London until I passed and came to school.
Goodness. So that must have been a real
eye-opener. It was.
Coming to London for the very first time.
It was indeed. Indeed. And my father had his pocket picked in the hotel and lost £50,
oh, no.
Which was a lot of money in those days.
Gosh.
Going up in the lift. So I learnt that London was a dangerous place.
So your father brought you to London?
And my parents brought me to London, yes.
And you stayed in a hotel before
we
starting
We stayed in
school.
A hotel, the Mount Royal Hotel up at Marble Arch, before being abandoned to my fate here.
And what were your first impressions of the school?
Well, I just couldn't believe I was really here. I thought that clock over there was a cutout. Wasn't really Big Ben. Looked a bit small, I thought. Sure, Big Ben should be smaller. I was just overwhelmed. Couldn't believe I was here in all these places, which one had read about as a child. And here I was in the midst of it, and going to services in Westminster Abbey. It was just mind-blowing.
I suppose it probably wouldn't have been a shock to you, the distraction that had been wrecked.
It was disappointment, I think. There were a lot of things. Laurie Tanner's book, the first edition on Westminster School, which I'd been given when I got my scholarship, and I read that avidly, and one read about, you know, the Latin play and the boxes in the college dormitory and all of that, and the school dress. And there was none of that. And there was, again, there were big air raid shelters in Yard. I thought I had some photographs, those I haven't anywhere, they're not particularly beautiful. And so, yes, it was a bit, not primitive, no, that's the word, but it was a bit shabby, yes. And the destruction, you know, school was empty, a shell, this was all a shell. And indeed, it was cool. It was given a temporary roof while I was here, but not the full rebuilding. That was after I'd left. So, yeah, that was, we were stuck in 19 Dean's Yard, which was a rabbit warren of a building, not designed as a boarding house at all.
No.
College Hall, that was all right. That hadn't been affected, but yes, there were static water tanks on Green. So there was definitely been a war.
Do you remember the rebuilding at all? Do you remember that going on? And was
Well, the rebuilding of college, yes, but it didn't obtrude. One wasn't conscious of concrete mixtures. And there wasn't an enormous amount of rebuilding. There was a knocking down at the air raid shelters. I don't know when the temporary, there was a temporary roof put on school before the present, and I just don't remember when that happened. And I couldn't give you a date of when they started rebuilding this building.
No.
But it must have been, you know, towards the end of my time here.
Mm. Were the spaces very much out of bounds?
Well, there wasn't much reason to come inside, really. No, I don't think I was conscious that there were places you couldn't go to. Mm. Yeah. Ashburnham was okay. That was pretty good, yes, and there were comfortable chairs in the library and so on.
Were you very crammed into 19 Dean's
Yard? We fitted in somehow, yes. Yes, it was a bit of a squash, I think.
What was the dormitory arrangement like?
Let me see. Yeah, I suppose we were quite crammed. You probably wouldn't be allowed that amount of cramming in. It was scattered around, and on the ground floor there were the day rooms. They call them election rooms, don't they?
For college, yes.
Yes, the election rooms, and then the dormitories were upstairs. And where the reception area is entrance, those were bathrooms. I said there were bathrooms there. Some of our college bathrooms were across there, in there.
And what were the other boys who joined at the same time as you like?
where the pictures on? They were fine. What can one say about them, really?
Did any of them come from the underschool? Had any of them?
I don't think any of them came from the underschool. Two of them, I think, came from Tormor. Does that still exist, Tormor?
It doesn't, but I've heard about it.
Yeah, there must. Two came from Tormor. There was another, the Liberty boy, Christopher Kingdon. His father was a bank manager in the Midland Bank, I think, which we from Lloyd tended to look down on. The next one was a David Seckerwalker. Well, he was from Tormor. Then there was me. Then there was somebody called Peter Petrie, whose father was Sir Charles Petrie, Baronet, the historian, who had some connection with Sherborne, so I knew that name before I came here. Then there was somebody called Thomas Fenister, whose father was the head of the Geological Survey Museum, a rather quaint Scott family. I got to know them quite well. Then there was Roxby Cox, whose father was one of those on the team that invented the jet engine. He became a peer, Lord Roxby Cox. He was a rather eminent scientist. And then there was somebody called Roger Robinson, whose father was in shipping. I think that's about it. And then two others got added later. For some reason, I can't remember quite how or why, but anyway, Stephen Barrett, who eventually became captain of the school, sort of joined our election. He was present the other day at that do. The senior boys, well, they all seemed very big and rather impressive. The monitors, they all seemed very big and rather fierce.
Did you have a substance?
Yes, I did. Yes, there's a picture. He's visible in some of those Greaves photographs. He was called Christopher Lummis. Yes, he was the year above. Yes, I had a substance.
And he helped you to settle in.
He helped me to settle. Yes, he's quite a jolly fellow. Was a very nice matron, Mrs. Hillary, Nita Hillary, and her charming daughter, who married. My fagmaster, Dick Lowe, whose son
teaches here, Charles Lowe.
Teaches here, Charles, yes, that's right. Well, Dick Lowe was my fagmaster.
So fagging was still going on?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Was tanning still going on? Can't remember. Didn't experience it.
Okay. And what sort of duties did you have to do as a flag?
That has totally eliminated from my memory.
Did you have a sense of it being unfair, or did you just get on with it?
It was part of the system, you know. That's what one read about schools.
And did you have a fag yourself in turn when you got older?
No. No, I didn't. I wasn't a monitor. I don't think there was the captain and three monitors out of an election, so there would be four who were just seniors. And I don't think a senior actually was entitled to a fag, because he had no duties as a senior. And I was one of those. We had a study, you know, in my last year, we did have a kind of study for two of us, which was rather nice. First one was that bay window over the entrance to Yard.
Oh, wonderful.
That was David Secker Walker and I shared that as a study. And then when we moved to here, I was up at the top of, is it number three, the Master of the Queen Scholars House?
Mm, yes.
Yes, it was up at the top of that, which I shared then, in my very last term, with that fellow, Ernest Ruppel.
Do any particular masters stand out in your mind?
Oh, yeah, yes, a lot of them do. I think particularly John Carlton, who was the English master, who then became house master and eventually then headmaster.
Mm-hmm.
John Christie, the headmaster, was rather remote. One didn't come across him very often. Fisher, the maths master, I've been told by the master in my prep school, who was instrumental in my coming here, obviously knew him quite well. And so I've been sort of told to look out for Preedy Fisher. He's sort of a good thing. I remember him, and then there was... Mr. Rudwick, was it Rudwick or Rudrick? Rudrick, I think. He was the physics master. He was head of Rigo's. He gave me a very bad report my first term. But we got on a bit better later. There was a chemistry master called Mr. Birch, with Mr. Troutbeck, but I don't think Troutbeck, he taught me. Mr. Shepherd was the Latin master. French master, Rawls, yes. Pinky Rawls. Yes, his son teaches here, doesn't he? Did?
I did.
Yes. Yes. Oh, and there was a German master, but I didn't have him until my second year, who'd actually been in Dachau, I think, before the war. And indeed, this chum of mine, Ernest Ruppel. His father had been in Buchenwald and had been got out. I don't know quite what his wife had to do to get him out. I never inquired, but anyway, they came and settled in England. So, if you like, there were these little connections into the darker side of the war, mm-hmm. One was conscious of here. Other masters, that's enough to be going on with, I think.
Did you still talk a lot?
Owen Simpson, of course, was my housemaster. He was a very strange character. I never really got on with him. Had a nice wife.
Yes, I was going to. You said you sort of were aware of this darker side of the war. Was it still something that you really sort of talked about, people's experiences or their parents' experiences?
That I can't remember. I mean, the bits I've just mentioned, yes, one from Ernest Ruppel about his parents, I would have heard from him.
Mm.
But, that's all. Oh, yes, there was such a thing. Mrs. Neville Chamberlain used to come to Abbey sometimes on Sundays and be asked in by, obviously, knew John Carlton, so she used to come and have a glass of sherry after the service sometimes. So, but the excitement of this place, from somebody in the country, suddenly these names that one read about in the paper, there they were all around you, close to. And the Maundy service, that 1948, because there was a Easter fell during the term time, and so the scholars all went to the service. I'd never heard Zadok the priest anthem when that suddenly burst forth. Fantastic piece of music. And there was the king. You know, there he was, and we were saying, long live the king, may he live forever, which he obviously couldn't. But for a little boy from the country, I mean, to be there, in Westminster Abbey, where this man had been crowned, there he was, and we were singing, God save. I mean, these things were fantastic. They made one big impression on somebody from a sort of country background.
Did you feel homesick towards...
No, I'd been at a boarding school anyway.
Right.
So, no, I loved being in London.
Yeah.
You know, it was just so exciting.
Yeah.
And later on, when I was a bit older, one could go to theatres and concerts, you know, Albert Hall on a Sunday afternoon. Festival Hall didn't exist then, of course. Mm. The Albert Hall was where one went. And then there were concerts in Central Hall on Saturday mornings. There were concerts for children, which we used to go to. And then all the music. Again, that Westminster opened my ears in a way that had never been opened. And there was just so much music. And every Sunday in the Abbey, and we used to go, those service sheets, so we used to go to all the big services in the Abbey, forget lessons. You know, they needed to make the procession nice and long and impressive. And all the scholars would be at all the big services, sitting around the Abbey.
Yeah.
And then you're listening to the services. So all of that was just hugely impressive.
Did you miss it in the holidays? Did you miss being in London?
The rather attractive distractions. Yes, and I don't recall that as sort of, no, I want to be in London. It was different.
Were there any subjects you particularly enjoyed learning?
If you want to, the education I had was really rather quaint. You know, I came here when I was 12,
mm-hmm.
and I was 13. All scholars had to sit their school certificate, GCSE equivalent, much, much harder than GCSE, within 1 year. And after that, you started specialising, preparatory to sixth form and so on. So in my first year, big spread, history, geography. I refused to do Greek and Roxby Cox. Monsieur, where is he? Is he in this list? No, he isn't. I told you he was one of the ones in, he was there. This one. he, the son of the scientist, he and I both said, no, we don't want to do Greek. All scholars were meant to do classics. But we said, no. I'd never done Greek and I didn't want to do Greek. And we did science, which was quite exceptional. Mm. So we had that. All of that for the first year. Then after you'd done your school certificate, you started specialising, ready for higher certificate and university. And I thought I wanted to do mathematics. Either the school didn't think I was particularly good at maths, or they thought it was too young to specialise. So they said, because I was still only 13, you better have a year and do something else. Go and do modern languages. So you then did German GCSE in 1 year, and French and some Latin and some English. And that was all that one did. I never did mathematics. I stayed doing modern languages, either because I was indolent, lazy, or what, I can't remember. Anyway, I didn't switch. So from the age of 13, I learned nothing but French and German and English and a bit of Latin. Now that is an appalling education. It really is. So narrow. Yeah. And it wouldn't be possible now.
Yeah. Did he feel hampered by that in later life, or?
You realise there's gaps, yes, and that you go on learning throughout life, yes. Well, economics wasn't taught anyway in those days. I don't know. Yes, it must be taught now, economics, but it wasn't on the syllabus. And we were only 250 boys, so it was quite. The school was very small.
Was there a sense of? I mean, you mentioned that your choice of doing science instead of Greek was rather frowned upon.
Yeah.
Was there a real sense of hierarchy between the subjects? You know, that science was a sort of lower.
I suppose there was a kind of feeling. You know, scholars did classics. If you weren't a scholar, you did something else. There was some kind of academic bias. That's how it was. How was the quality of teaching? I had Rawls was my French teacher almost entirely throughout my time here. The German master who first did German, the one who was in Dachau, he left and was replaced by the one I mentioned, Dr. Garten, who knew Hugo von Hofmannsthal, who used to write me the most glowing reports. He was very good on music too. He did musical appreciation. He was a good teacher, a bit quaint, but he was good. I know some people, you will have others who will have talked to, would sing the praises of, was it Walter Monk, who was a history master,
yes.
And Charles Keeley. They became heroes for them. I don't think anybody became a hero for me. I mean, John Carlton, as a person, a very civilised person. Oh, I said Stephen Lushington. Yes, he was rather civilised. He had flowers on his desk, and dressed rather nattily. I think he's died now, hasn't he,
yes,
Stephen
just
Lushington?
Quite recently.
I remember going up to him at the last time I ever saw him, one at Camem about 3 or 4 years ago. I did rather admire him. I thought he seemed, it'd be nice to be as sort of grand and elegant as he was. Anyway, I went up to him and said, I don't suppose you remember meeting him. All I said, no, I don't. I had the same encounter with the Roger Norrington, the conductor, the Cardiff Singer of the Year. He was one of the judges and I was there. And I went up to him in the interval. I said, I don't suppose you remember me, Roger, but we were at school together. He said, no, I don't. And turned to somebody else. So that's happened. Anyway, but John Carlton, yes, became almost a friend, I think. And I suppose the direction my life subsequently took was much influenced by his advice. Because I was doing languages, I was a real anorak train spotter. You might get that in the reports, if only you think of something other than trains. All those London terminuses, were marvellous, with real big proper trains. I wanted to be general manager of the Great Western Railway, that's right. And he said, well, you don't really actually want to make your working life your same as your hobbies, if you like. You should think something else. If you're doing languages, you ought to think of the Foreign Office. Well, in a sense, that's the direction in which I went, for better or for worse. And I suppose his influence. But he was particularly keen on the Abbey. He used to take us round the Abbey, take us round London, but particularly the Abbey. And he taught me to love the Abbey architecture, and everything to do with the Abbey. So John Carlton, yes, was a big influence, I think.
Did you meet Lawrence Tanner, whose book you read?
I did meet Lawrence Tanner, and actually my brother, the father of one of my brothers, no, the mother of one of my brother's friends, was actually Lawrence Tanner's sister, so there was some sort of connection. Then there was another version of the book came out, the photographs were taken for that in 1950. And I know my picture is in that book in three or four different places. if you've got it, I can point them out. in that, I don't think there's been another edition.
No, there hasn't. Mm. But it's still a wonderful history of the school.
Yes, it is. It's very good. Yes. Yes, I mean, Lawrence Teller, I didn't get to know him. Well, I met him. I mean, they were all these rather august big people. And one was just a little boy.
Did you feel that there was a sort of strong hierarchical nature in the school that you know, when you joined?
Yeah, I suppose. Yes, not oppressive.
Hmm.
I had been brought up in a sort of kind of ordered society where people had their place and so on and didn't challenge it. and there it was. And you realise that the idea was in due course, you would end up in the position which you had suffered from when you started. But of course it all changed as privilege recedes as you advance towards it. It's like, I remember my prep school, you used to get second helpings if you were a senior boy. But by the time I became a senior boy, it all became democratic and everyone took turns. There were certain little privileges. Like, does that still happen on Sundays? The scholars could go onto the terrace of the House of Commons?
I don't know quite what the status is of our parliamentary privileges. I don't know how much they still use them.
But we could go on after Abbey on a Sunday morning. If we were in a school dress, as you always were if you'd been to Abbey on Sunday morning, you could go across and walk on the terrace of House Commons.
That must have been wonderful.
Well, you know, again, for a little boy from the country, it was unbelievable. You had to do it even if you'd done it lots of times before and it hadn't changed, but you know, this is a privilege you had to exercise.
What about the more mundane side of life? I was just wondering about things like, you know, what was the food like?
Oh, pretty ghastly. It was rationed.
Mm.
It was rationing. No, the food was not particularly good.
Did you eat in college
hall?
Yes,
all meals in college hall. Trips round.
And was it just the scholars that ate in college hall at that stage?
No, I can't remember. Well, at lunchtime, it was the whole school. Well, the Busbys also did. I can't remember. They may have done. But certainly college. We had all breakfast, lunch and whatever it was we had in the evening. It was all in college hall. And if you're in your first year, you mustn't walk on Mr. Flood Jones's grave in the cloisters.
Oh, really? I've not heard that one either.
Samuel Flood Jones. Mm-hmm. For some reason, we didn't go the obvious way. Well, I don't understand this now. Why didn't we go down through Dean's Yard?
No, you
didn't. We used to go through the cloisters. and on the last bit before the archway through, there is Samuel Flood Jones. And if you were in your first year, you weren't allowed to go to Samuel Flood Jones.
Yes, I've never heard that before.
Yeah,
that's
another one, right? then on... most of us would be in college at the weekend. I mean, some people did go away for weekends, but it was by no means a weekly boarder as I think now he is, mm-hmm. the school. So there'd be quite a lot of people here. And we, the scholars, were obliged to go to matins in the Abbey. So we would dress up in all of that stuff, which, you know, wasn't quite fancy. It was quite nice. Join the procession and sit in the choir stalls in the Abbey. And when, I think I said this when we were having lunch, one of the canons, Canon Stephen Marriott, where he was the archdeacon, he was a bit of a blood and thunder preacher. When he was preaching, old Queen Mary, the Queen Mother, the widow of King George V, would come to matins, and she would come to the Dean's Yard entrance. She'd be met by the Dean, and then she would process in past all the scholars lined up, and she liked that because she went by. Again, you know, I mean, one had heard of kings and queens down in deepest Dorset. And here was the Queen Mother coming past me every Sunday, you know. I mean, it was unbelievable. Yeah, she was. She didn't say anything. There once when the sub-dean, Canon Donaldson, who had been in the March of the Unemployed from Jarrow to London in the 1920s, he was sub-dean. He was very little and very fragile. And the dean was away, and he was taking the Queen Mum in. And as he, and here, Your Majesty, are the King's scholars. How many are there? You can see, ma'am, for yourself. How many are there? Oh. He'd forgotten the magic 40. Yeah. She wouldn't let him get away with it.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's just a trivial anecdote, which sticks in the mind. I suppose there's a little another connection with the Abbey. I told you a master at my prep school had sent three other boys to Westminster. Not long after I'd come here, he became a headmaster of the choir school.
Ah.
So there he was on the other side of Dean's Yard. And I think I mentioned one of the photographs there, that was the wife of the headmaster of the choir school. Well, that's why I know, because that was a place I could sort of go and kind of home from home.
Yeah.
And also give another insight into all the Abbey business, all the gossip of the Abbey, which is always fascinating. The canons fighting against each other and all the rest of it.
What did... Did you think did the Abbey have a good relationship with the school at that stage?
Yes, I think so. Yes. I mean, we were very conscious, we were part of it.
Mm.
And then in 1947 there was the Queen's wedding, for which eight of us were in the procession, not me, the more senior boys were actually in the procession. That was a bit off that we weren't all in the procession for that occasion. But the rest of us were ushers in the Abbey, showing people. So we were also in the Abbey on the evening before when there was a rehearsal going on. And there was, the whole of the royal family was there, larking about. I probably haven't got that. I thought it was very wrong. They were sort of joking and digging each other in the ribs and so on in front of the high altar, you know, and they weren't behaving in a seemly manner, the king and the queen and the duke and all of them. But then on the service itself, I was in the nave, and we were showing people from the west door to their seats in the nave. I know I made a particular point of showing Anthony Eden to his seat. He was then in opposition, but I saw him coming. I'm going to have you. So that was a big occasion, yes. I mean, those are all wonderful things.
And you were here when college was reopened.
Yes.
Which must have been...
That was a big do, yes. We had all that stuff in the garden, and then King and Queen came round, and we were sort of stuck I was in one of the dormitories, I think. Council, the King and Queen and so on when they came round. Yeah, it was a sort of big day. I felt very grand. But then I was that was in my last term. Because I took Oxford entrance when I was 16 and failed, because I was frankly too young, I was told to try again a year later. Well, that was beyond my 5 years. So arrangements were made, for which I suppose I should be most grateful, for me to be kind of supernumerary in the play term of 1950, in order to sit the election at the end of 1950. And so I had an extra term beyond my 5 years. So I was a kind of elder statesman sort of hovering about. I wasn't a monist, I was just another senior. And then happily did ask to pick up a place at Christchurch. you haven't asked me about games and sport.
Do tell us.
Not my area of interest or achievement at all. I was encouraged by this master at Sherborne, that rowing would be the thing to do. You won't have to play cricket, you won't have to play football. There wasn't ghastly rugby anyway. You won't have to do cricket or football. You can row. So I took up rowing. Same old boathouse down at Putney. We used to go down by bus. We used to have a bus to take us down. Then that economy drive or something. In the end, we used to go down by underground to Putney Bridge and then walk. Well, I didn't excel at rowing either. And so I had to find ways of doing as little as possible, which I usually succeeded. then we had scouts. I don't know if they still have Boy Scouts here.
No, they don't.
And you could either do Corps, Combined Cadet Force, playing soldiers, or Scouts on, I forget, one afternoon. There were two afternoons of station, they call it?
Yes, that's right.
Tuesday and Saturday, I think. And then, I can't remember, it doesn't matter, Wednesday or Thursday was Corps or Scouts. Well, I had been a scout at my prep school, so I became a scout, but it didn't take it very seriously, and I thought that was all wrong. And they really, it was just a kind of opportunity for having a lark, really. Later on there was something called the pre-entry training squad, PETS, for boys who were too, I can't think why this was necessary, who were too young to become scouts or join the corps, which certainly wasn't the case when I started the school, but this was introduced later on. And this was under the charge of Jumbo Wilson, ginger beard chap who was housemaster eventually at Grants. And I became in charge of the PETS, which meant that one had to find occupations of some kind or other for these poor little boys in their first year on Wednesday afternoons and on field days when everybody else would go off playing soldiers somewhere or going camping or doing something ghastly like that. So Nigel Lawson and I, the chap became Chancellor Exchequer, he and I ran the pre-entry training squad for a time in our sort of last years or so, which was splendid on field days because in the morning we had to do something like show them around the Abbey or tell them about Gothic architecture or something, I can't remember what. And in the afternoon we'd take ourselves off to a matinee. And I saw some wonderful, Nigel and I used to go to these wonderful plays. We'll go and see the Marx Brothers up at the Everyman Hampstead. So that was the thing. So one find ways of adjusting to away from the things that didn't appeal. Westminster was good. You were allowed to be yourself. You weren't moulded into a particular shape. Though I suppose you had to appreciate music. And the fact that I rather like sort of trivial things like railway trends and models and things, that wasn't quite intellectual enough, so I was a bit below the pale on that sort of thing. But,
so did you have to keep it to yourself?
Well, I would find one or two friends. I mean, Thomas Femister, he turned out to like trains, and somebody called Nicholas Barker, who's a rather eminent librarian, Nicholas Barker, I think. You found a few people who had similar tastes. And so, yes, you didn't flaunt the things that were likely to attract mockery.
And what other
cool.
I mean, I knew you were in the Latin play one year.
Latin play didn't exist. No,
of course, it was the years when we didn't have a Latin play.
There was no Latin play during my time. Yes, that was a slight disappointment. There was no Latin play. That seemed to be rather fun and exciting and all of that, but that's gone. Does it happen now?
It does happen, but not on an annual basis. So the last one was in 2010.
No, this was done in English. How that happened and why it happened, I can't remember. Who was the driving force behind this? Brian Eccles? Anyway, there were some people who were particularly started this up. So there were school plays. I think this was the Claudius, was it?
We're looking at an entry in the Elizabethan for Julius Caesar.
But I don't remember any other college play during my time. I don't think I acted in any other play during my time. I returned to doing that sort of thing at Oxford, but not at school. But there were, as you will see from the material I've written, quite a lot of house plays going on. And sometimes school plays. So there was a certain amount of that going on, but no Latin plays.
And the Greys, I suppose the other big Westminster tradition we think of, did start again.
Oh yes, that began. I was quite clear I had no wish to participate in that game brawl. But yes, that happened, yes. Oh, you know, it was an exciting break from normal lessons. And we used to have to do physical jerks in yard, you know, in break.
I've seen some photographs of that.
Yeah. But happily, I never had to do anything like gym, because there wasn't much in the way of that sort of facility. I think the gym had been damaged during the war, actually.
It could well have been.
There was no pressure to, in some schools you would have to go into the gymnasium and do terrible ropes and horses and things like that. But no, not here.
And the election dinner, what are your memories of that?
A jolly jape. No particular memories. No particular memories of that. You know, yes, it was fun, an occasion. Was there a sort of play term, end of play term dinner? Oh, it was a bit better than normal food. Yes.
And I suppose to round us off, I wondered if you'd just do a sort of, it's very difficult, but a sort of a recap of your career, what you went on to do after leaving Westminster.
Right, well, I went to Christchurch, thanks to Queen Elizabeth I, exhibition, and read modern languages. I was the first ever Oxford undergraduate to go and spend a year in the country of the language you were learning during my degree time. It was distinctly frowned upon. You're not here to learn the mechanics of a language. You're meant to learn civilization and literature. But my mother, I mentioned this way back in the conversation, had done modern languages, or French, at Exeter. And all her work had been done in French, and she had to go and spend a year in France. And I saw an advertisement asking for people to apply to be assistants in French schools, and I thought, right, this is a good idea. My tutor was strongly opposed to it. Anyway, we had to fight, and eventually I succeeded, and was the first ever. Now it's compulsory. Years later, my daughter, who'd had a year in France and was reading French and history at Oxford, said, "I don't need to go to France." Says, "You've got to go." And she was made to go.
Yeah.
So one should hesitate in starting a tradition. You never know which member of the family will suffer from it later. Anyway, so then to my surprise, I got a first-class degree at Oxford. I then had to do military service. That was a total waste of time. Ghastly. 2 years of another rank. I tried so hard to get out of it that I wasn't thought to be fit enough to be an officer. though I did go to Cyprus, which was interesting. And I tried to get into the Foreign Office and failed. I tried to get into the Home Civil Service by what is now the way in, a sort of test interviews and some written exam, and failed that too. But there was still another way in which was predominantly academic, and I took that and passed. So my last year in Oxford, from January to August, I was taking exams, I think every other week, because you started the Foreign Office exam, then that would trundle on through its different stages until the early summer. Then you had your Oxford finals. Then there was, you had this academic exam, which wasn't the same syllabus, so you had to mug up a whole lot of extra stuff. Then that exam lasts about a fortnight. And then there was the viva for your degree, which, unless you were an absolute star, you had to do some work for. I know I'd chosen a subject for an essay. My tutor said, but we haven't done that. So they'll ask it on your viva. You'll have to learn a whole new area. So I did. And it all worked anyway. So from January to August, I was doing exams non-stop, it seemed. Somehow I survived. Anyway, got into the Home Civil Service, and by a delicious irony, not long had I been in the Home Civil Service, I was posted to be something called the Civil Air Attaché in the Middle East, which meant that I was, hey presto, seconded to the diplomatic service, which I failed to get into. And then many, many years later, I was made head of the what was then the Overseas Development Administration, now called DFID, you know, the aid programme. It was part of the Foreign Office, and there was I, having failed to get in the Foreign Office, I was a permanent secretary in the Foreign Office, so that was quite nice. But so I had a whole variety. I was in the civil service from 1957 until 1993, when at the age of 60 you are forced to retire. And then I had 20 years post-retirement career of different kinds, doing, you know, umpteen different types of jobs, which was very informative and instructive and interesting. Do you want to silence that? The detail of all of that, if you look at who's who, it's there. So that's me.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah. Is there anything you wanted to say that we didn't give you a chance to say?
Well, after talking non-stop for an hour. And then, to my surprise, in my retirement period, I was invited to join the Busby Trust as one of Dr. Busby's trustees.
Yeah.
Then became the chairman, and I was chairman of Dr. Busby's trustees for 10 years. I stepped down a year or two ago, but I'm still a Dr. Busby's trustee, which was a way of doing something back for the school, not very arduous. It brought me into contact with the school again, which was